So, continuing on with what we've been doing for the last few days about realizing the distinction between the works of God and the works of men and women is also then realizing how hard the mission of the gospel actually is. And one of the elements of that makes proclaiming the gospel incredibly difficult is going to a people that are not your own. And I learned this when I was in the seminary. It's a really painful thing to go to a people, to go to a community with whom you do not share certain sensibilities. And this was the topic of conversation almost always of international guys. So a guy that would come from Vietnam or from the Philippines or from Africa, or a guy in Alberta who's from Manitoba and thinks Albertans are crazy, or the guys that are from Edmonton and then are now stuck in Calgary and everybody worships the Calgary Flames and he knows better that they have to worship the Edmonton Oilers. That going among strangers is an incredibly difficult thing. And sometimes, too, we can make forget the distinction between sometimes caring for others as God intends us to care for them and caring for others because they are, in fact, our own. So here is an interesting example. And it's not a bad example, but it's an interesting example. When we volunteer for something because our kids are in that group, and then we stop when our kids are no longer in that group, that's a good thing. But that is not what we call supernatural grace. Supernatural grace means caring for others even when they are not yours. And this is what defines the power and presence of God in our mission. Because, of course, anybody can care for their own. To paraphrase the Savior, even the Gentiles do that. What you should do is care for those who hate you, who disagree with you, who look different than you, have a different skin color, speak a different language than you. Because that will be what reveals your heart. Do you give because God gives, or do you give because it makes you feel good? And this is not easy. And in fact, I've met a lot of missionaries crash and burn because they think they're doing it and they're not. And then usually what makes them crash and burn is the realization that in the end, they've only ministered to those whom they like. And I'm pretty sure as parishioners and as people, you've encountered it on the flip side. So this is not what we intend on being as Christians. And St. Anselm of Canterbury, or St. Anselm of Beck, is today's saint. And he's one of my favorites, not just for the obvious reason. But the major reason that I really grew to like him was I first encountered him when I was studying philosophy at the University of Victoria. Whenever you do an arguments for the existence of God, Anselm of Canterbury's what's called ontological argument is one of the first ones that's thrown right at you. And the funny thing is if you read it properly, that have you ever heard Dawkins and that whole flying spaghetti monster thing? If Dawkins would actually read Anselm, he would have to shut up. He's 900 years behind the curve, that a medieval monk and bishop outsmarted him long before he was born, because what Anselm is saying is that it's in God's nature to exist. Not a flying spaghetti monster, not Gonolo would say a giant island, but God by his own nature must exist. It's a matter of necessity. But another thing that Anselm also pointed out is that it's a matter of necessity for God to want to save us. Not because he owes us, but that he owes himself. That God is love, and that from his innermost being, he wants to do what is best for his people. Even if that means biting the bullet and suffering. So when Anselm is often mischaracterized as the guy who has Jesus suffering to appease an angry father, it is the most gross misreading of St. Anselm you can imagine. That Jesus willingly does this to honor his father, to make his father visible by showing how far he is willing to go for his wayward children. And that became an image that also manifested Anselm's own ministry. And Anselm was actually one of the last great theologian bishops. This is another reason I like the guy. You see, in around the 13th century, theologians and pastoral ministry, they started to split up because the universities were established and you started having trained all these guys academically trained. But Anselm and the church fathers, they were bishops and priests, etc., and monks who would use the preaching of the gospel, catechizing the people as the basis of their theology. That these weren't books meant for people that, you know, only interested in academia. These would be things preached from this. And I was blown away by this guy. But what Anselm did in his lifetime, and it's really quite interesting, is that he first wanted to become a monk because he was attracted to the life and he was attracted to the abbot named Lanfranc. Eventually, Lanfranc was dragged out of the monastery and forced to become the Bishop of Canterbury when the Normans conquered England. It wasn't England at the time, but use your imagination. It was the conquest of the Saxons by the Normans. France, England, all of these things don't exist yet. So they conquered it, and then they wanted to exhibit a type of religious control, social control, so they replaced all of the higher echelons of the religious hierarchy with a bunch of Frenchmen. And when eventually Lanfranc died, soon after, then they sent Anselm to continue the job. They figured, he's a Frenchman, we can control him, we can be able to have him exert our religious and cultural authority over the English. And what this Frenchman did is that he became an Englishman. And if you look at the history of most of the saints, this is generally what happens. My favorite example, of course, is St. Patrick was not Irish. A lot of the great missionaries that brought the gospel to someone were foreigners who went out of their way to adopt the culture in which they entered. The Jesuits that first came to Canada and evangelized the first peoples, learned the languages of the first peoples, adopted their culture. It was only the later religious nut jobs that came in and tried to Europeanize them. So Anselm goes into England, and then he works as hard as he can to not only adopt the English culture for his own, but then also to help the religion become a way for the English people to keep their identity. So you can only imagine, the kings were not entirely happy about this. And so Anselm was occasionally exiled from time to time, thrown out of his diocese, thrown out of his home, not actually allowed to do what it is that he was sent to do. But eventually, just by his own character, Anselm was vindicated. That you can only persecute a saint for so long before everyone who's been pointing their finger and saying all sorts of nasty things just have to shut up and realize that they were wrong. Jeremiah talks about this in his prophecy when he says that they will look on him whom they have pierced, and they will weep for themselves because they have done such a thing. And the same thing happens to the centurion when they crucify Jesus, and then he goes, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." It's the same phenomenon, but not the same thing. So Anselm eventually is vindicated and revealed to be a saint. And what I find is really interesting is how he put together his love for his people, his love for the truth, all of this in this one quite interesting package. And I have to tell you, there's another thing about him that I really quite like, is that he didn't want to become a bishop either. They dragged him out of France just like they dragged out his predecessor. And he never liked the administration. He never liked having to attend meetings with a bunch of boring nobles. He was much more interested in taking care of people. This is such an amazingly beautiful thing. And I think that when we also poo-poo an entire generation and part of history, we don't realize that these witnesses exist in our church's history. They're all over. A great cloud of witnesses that make Christ more and more visible in each passing generation. Because Jesus himself is a foreigner in our own land. For we are not greater than our master. He was born in the Father's house, a land of peace and joy, and I don't want to use the word prosperity, but I can't think of a better one. And he saw us. He saw us. And I know we constructed our own demise. We constructed our own misery. we constructed our own sadness. And he decided that the best thing to do would be to wash our feet. We wouldn't understand what he was doing when he started doing it, just as he told his disciples, but that is exactly to be expected. And of course, even some of his most intimate disciples will lift their heel against him and try to destroy him, but that's going to happen too. And Jesus gave us this little warning, and I think it was very encouraging. Very truly, I tell you, whoever receives one whom I send receives me, and whoever receives me receives him who sent me. In the end, being a Christian is not knowing all of the details about the life of some obscure saint. I'm pretty sure you know a few obscure saints that I have no idea about. These things don't make us Christians. It also doesn't make us a Christian as to how good we are with certain groups of people or all of these other things. It all in the end comes down to how do we welcome Christ when he comes to us? Because you really have no idea how it's going to happen. When I was ordained, I had no idea I would wind up here. But I'm thankful it happened.